Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, March 6th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Landmark Hotel may become Hilton. Deal in works to redevelop site into tapestry project. From Urbana. How about a Hilton Hotel in downtown Urbana? City officials say the redevelopment deal they've got cooking for the Urbana Landmark Hotel involves turning the 94-year-old downtown property into a tapestry collection by Hilton Hotel. Tapestry is a new brand launched by the Hilton chain in January, with each property intended to be unique. There were 7 tapestry projects in 6 cities, plus 35 more in the works, announced with the brand launch. The developer of the Urbana Landmark Hotel site, Glen Rock, a New Jersey-based Crimson Rock Capital, is working out terms with Hilton to make it one of the new tapestry collection by Hilton properties. Dionis Rodriguez, the founder and managing principal of Crimson Rock Capital, said other compelling brand options exist for the Urbana project, but Hilton is at the top of the list. He said he was excited about the option and believes it will be a strong fit for Urbana. According to the city, Crimson Rock would fully renovate the vacant 128-room hotel at 210 South Race Street to return it to top-of-the-market standards but preserve its historic character. The company would fully reactivate all the rooms and reopen the restaurant, bar, and conference center. Urbana is being asked to lend a hand to the tune of $9.5 million in bonds issued post-construction to be paid off with, in part, with projected hotel food and beverage taxes and a new special boutique hotel motel tax that would apply to only to this property, according to Urbana community developer Libby Tyler. The Urbana City Council will be asked to get on board with necessary approvals later this month. The city wouldn't be investing any money for a couple of years. Construction likely wouldn't be starting until next year. Work has been underway with this developer for several months. This is a big part of Mayor Prussing's work that she'd like to complete. Urbana Mayor Laurel Prussing, who lost her bid for re-election in last week's Democratic primary election, said she wants to get this one done. She's a frequent Hilton customer and looking forward to bringing this brand to Urbana. It's a fantastic opportunity for the city. This is a gem, she said. The developer has plans to make the property beautiful, and the potential for downtown is transformative. Hotels have become economic development drivers for downtowns, and Prussing believes this one can help do the same for Urbana. Plus, you can't just let a property like that deteriorate, she said of the Urbana Landmark Hotel. You can't just say someday somebody is going to come and buy this and build an eco-friendly hotel. Prussing says she wants the public to know the city staff has done its homework on this project, which has included using hotel and financial consultants. We haven't just done this willy-nilly, she said. And don't forget the University of Illinois can help feed the market for these hotel rooms. That's one of the things we know. There's a huge market for boutique hotels in college towns. Rodriguez said his company has executed a term sheet with Hilton, indicating strong interest to make the Urbana Hotel part of its system. Crimson Rock Capital describes itself as a private investment firm focused on U.S. investment opportunities that are distressed, inefficient, value-added, or have significant long-term growth potential. It partners with leading hotel operators and investors. It's teaming up on the Urbana project with New York-based hotel renovation management firm Walsh Associates and Newcastle Hotels and Resorts, a hotel management and development company based in Connecticut with more than 3,000 rooms. They'll be working with Campo Architects of New Orleans, which specializes in historic properties, on the Urbana Landmark Hotel project. The Tudor-style hotel first opened in 1923 as the Urbana Lincoln Hotel and acquired its Bavarian-style addition in the 1970s. It went through ownerships by Carson Perry Scott and the Jumers Hotel chain before its most recent owner, J.X. Wan, bought it in 2010 with renovation plans and put it up for sale in 2015. Former combat medic, proud of Vietnam service, from Rantoul. Jerry Weiss lost 8 friends and comrades in his platoon on a single bloody day in Vietnam, where he served as a combat medic who carried an M16 along with his bandages. He is proud of his service in a divisive war and is also the event coordinator for the National 2017 Vietnam Veterans Reunion to be held in Effingham in September. Wise didn't choose to be a medic, but scored so well on tests, which he entered randomly, that he was assigned to the position. On his wall hang certificates for the Bronze Star and Vietnamese Legion of Honor for a series of 6-week missions in 1971. There's also a soft hat on a shelf soaked with Vietnam sweat that he wore instead of a heavy helmet. Wise's father was in the Air Force, which caused the family to move around a lot. Wise himself was 18 and having trouble with a girlfriend who was dating an airman at Chanute Air Force Base when he volunteered for the Army. I figured if she liked uniforms, I'd get one too. He remembers it was not long after the shootings at Kent State University that he took the train from Rantoul here. He went to a barbershop near the Army recruiting office in downtown Champaign. He told the barber to take it all off, military style. Then I walked through the anti-war protesters into the recruiting station. Wise was in a rush to get into action, but the recruiters told him to slow down. I wanted to go overseas, but they told me you couldn't volunteer for Vietnam until you graduated from basic and had more training. Wise gave them an ultimatum, basically, I'm out of here if I don't ship out today, and the recruiters backed down. On his 19th birthday, the medic was in Vietnam, in country, and in fact, very deep in country. He served with Charlie Company, 4th Battalion, 21st Infantry, 11th Light Infantry Brigade. On April 23, 1971, the Specialist E-4 and members of his platoon were dug in against enemy fire. An artillery shell exploded, and the medic had to go to work bandaging badly wounded soldiers. 7 died at the scene. Wise says he didn't use the morphine he had with him to medicate the wounded because of its effects on the respiratory system. Doctors would soon be checking their vitals, and the drug would interfere with that. You were never far from a medical base by helicopter, no more than 20 minutes. Even mundane life was difficult in the jungle when you're carrying an M16 rifle and a full load of equipment. On 6-week missions out of Fire Base San Juan Hill, we humped our rucksacks all day long. That rucksack had everything you owned. Besides the rifle, that meant 20 pounds of ammo, 2 hand grenades, 2 smoke grenades, 8 quarts of water, food, medicine, and whatever else you might need over the course of weeks. His gear weighed easily 70 pounds. It was so heavy that once I literally could not get up from the ground without a guy giving me a hand. He even kept a towel on his shoulder to keep the straps from cutting into his skin. Wise retired after 35 years at Kraft to a home full of memorabilia from his years in service, military service organizations, and his collections. He and wife Shirley have 6 children between them. I'm certainly proud of what I did, he says. It was the greatest adventure of my life. He believes Vietnam veterans have never received the acclaim they deserve, as have veterans from other armed conflicts. Wise encourages other veterans to embrace their patriotism and celebrate their service. He is an organizer of the planned 2017 Vietnam Veterans Festival, which will be held near Effingham on September 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Police are looking to buy 6 new cars from Champaign. The city's police vehicle fleet could soon add 6 new squad cars, price tag $173,910, if city council members give the proposal their blessing on Tuesday. If okayed, 6 2017 Ford Police Interceptor SUVs would replace 4 2013 sedans, 1 2013 SUV, and 1 2011 Crown Victoria. All are in at the end of their established life cycles, according to a city report. One of those cars would be reassigned to Public Works for its multimodal corridor enhancement project, 4 would go to Unit 4 school resource officers, and 1 would be sold. The vote also includes a motion to designate 5 old squad cars as surplus to be sold via online auction. The new cars, which would come from Greenfield's Morrow Brothers Ford, mainly differ from the current ones in size and drive type. They have higher ground clearance to bypass snow and water flooding, bigger interior dimensions, and an all-wheel drive instead of rear-wheel drive. Senseless tragedy. Police believe U of I student's fatal fall was an accident. Champaign police believe a University of Illinois student's death on Friday after a fall from his apartment balcony was a tragic accident. The passing of Jonathan Morales, 23, brings to three the number of deaths in the last 11 years associated with the annual spring bacchanal on campus known as unofficial St. Patrick's Day. Shortly after 10:30 p.m., police were sent to 51 East John Street, where they found Mr. Morales unresponsive on the concrete surface of the interior courtyard. He was taken to Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana, where he died at 11:50 p.m. An autopsy was done Saturday morning. Champaign Detective Sergeant Dennis Blazell said Mr. Morales was in his own apartment on the fourth floor with four other people. By all accounts, this would appear to be accidental. There wasn't a big party, it's just a few friends gathered that had planned to go out later. Included in the group was Mr. Morales' brother. Blazell said he was not certain if any of the others were near Mr. Morales or saw what happened, as another detective assisted with interviews that he had not had a chance to review on Saturday. People were coming and going. One of the kids said it was a little warm in the apartment and they had the door open. There were neighbors next door who said they went out to smoke. Blazell estimated the balcony to be 8 feet wide and 5 feet deep. The detective said police learned that Mr. Morales had been drinking earlier in the day as part of the unofficial St. Patrick's Day activities. He and his roommate were out earlier, came home, took naps. Friends came from up north and they started drinking again and socializing. I can't say what condition he was in, said Blazell, who said the group had been together for about an hour prior to the fall. As long as there are balconies, students, and alcohol, we are going to have falls, said the veteran police officer. It all comes down to good judgment and making sound decisions. Mr. Morales was a junior from Franklin Park, majoring in communication. Instructor Kate DeWig Morris called him a bright spot among her students. When you teach at 9 a.m. three times a week, it's tough to have students who are consistently present, awake, and ready to jump in. John Morales is one of those students. He was a bright spot in my small business communication class, always engaged, smiling, and respectful to me and the other students in class. Slightly older than the others, John was establishing himself as a solid anchor among the others. We were just gaining momentum, just getting things accomplished, when it was all cut short. On behalf of the other students in class, I offer my deepest sympathies to John's family, and I shall miss him very, very much. U of I Chancellor Robert Jones echoed her sentiments. We are saddened over the death of a young man who had promise, potential, and his whole life ahead of him. On behalf of the university, I offer sincere condolences to his family and friends. Going forward, we must find a way to work together as a community to end this event and avoid more senseless tragedy. U of I spokeswoman Robin Kaler observed that until Mr. Morales' fall, the day had been manageable. There was a heavy police presence on campus with an emphasis on safety. Until this happened, people were saying it seemed really quiet and more subdued this year. The university tries to counteract the event, which it does not condone, and considers an embarrassment with education. We, of course, do alcohol responsibility training with all students when they start. We send a letter to parents a few weeks ahead of unofficial, asking them to talk with their children. Police and student volunteers go around to areas where students live and talk to students about making good choices. The U of I Police Department also promotes safe behavior through social media and enlists the cooperation of apartment owners. Part of the education effort specifies balconies. Please don't go out on balconies. It's really dangerous. We've lost a human being for no good reason. Preliminary numbers of Friday's police activity revealed that 112 notices to appear in court were issued to people for such crimes as carrying alcohol in public, battery, and minors in possession of alcohol. That figure was down from 152 last year. There were also about 20 people taken to hospitals for intoxication. On Saturday morning, a representative of the U of I Dean of Students office was handing out contact cards to residents of Mr. Morales' apartment building in case any of them needed U of I resources to deal with the tragedy. Also on the front page, the $1.6 million question in big-time college athletics, hiring and firing is costly business. Just when things were going so well, John Groch's Illini wrapped up the regular season Saturday with an airball. A 62-59 loss to last-place Rutgers snapped Illinois' four-game winning streak, and barring a 4-wins-in-4-days effort at this week's Big Ten tournament in Washington, D.C., all but assured that it will miss the NCAA tournament for a fourth straight year. The last time that happened, the early Lou Henson years, 1977-80. It also renewed calls for coaching change from flustered fans on WDWS's post-game show and social media. At major programs like the U of I's, that means opening up the vault, from hiring a search firm to paying buyouts to courting candidates. The process is an expensive one. Staff writers Marcus Jackson and Willie Worth examine the costs that come with the hiring and firing of power conference coaches. First of all, the going rate. More, more, more. Little did we know then when day two of the Josh Whitman era would have Lovie Smith flying in from Florida to be introduced as Illinois' new football coach, hours after Bill Cubitt was fired. So there's reason to believe the Illini AD would aim high if he decided change was in order to atop a basketball program. The difference between now and the other times Illinois went looking for a new basketball coach, schools outside the Power Five conferences are prepared to pay big bucks to keep a rising coaching star from leaving. When it's making it harder for schools like in Illinois, is the gap is losing in terms of the smaller schools, said Darren Rovell, who covers the business side of sports for ESPN. The fact that Brad Stevens stayed so long at Butler and Mark Few at Gonzaga, guys like that have stayed and put some pressure on the power schools to be able to pay a little bit more. As more guys have stayed, coaches are thinking it's fine to stay. If an AD really wants a guy, that could add, over a five-year deal, an additional $350,000 a year, so we're talking another $1.75 million that you might have to pay a guy. Groch makes $1.7 million annually, about $500,000 less than Josh Pastner, who made the jump from Memphis to Georgia Tech last year. The last coach to visit State Farm Center, Tom Izzo, is paid $4.15 million a year at Michigan State. The $3 million-plus club includes Indiana's Tom Crean. Tulsa's attorney, Stuart Campbell, whose clients include former U of I coach Bill Self of Kansas, says there's no such thing anymore as a going rate for a coveted coach who might be willing to make a move up, like Dayton's Archie Miller or Wichita State's Greg Marshall. I couldn't even begin to guess what a number would be right now. When you're hot coaches, you have to jump and you try to get as much as possible. Another area, the buyout, $1.6 million. Illinois got off cheap in terminating Tim Beckman's contract 2 years early, cutting the former football coach a $250,000 check and moving on. But that's not how this goes most of the time. The Beckman case involves special circumstances because of accusations of player mistreatment. U of I officials believe they had cause to avoid paying the full $3.1 million left on his contract. Losing too many games, the reason most coaches are let go, does not qualify as cause and entitles coaches to hefty buyouts like the ones paid to Ron Zook, Bruce Weber, and Gillette Law in 2011 and 12. Former athletic director Mike Thomas, who himself received a $2.5 million buyout last year, negotiated less pricey penalties in the contracts of the coaches he hired, including John Groch. If Groch were let go without cause after this season, he'd be due 2 times his $400,000 base salary, multiplied by the years remaining on his contract, too. That adds up to $1.6 million, far less than the $3.9 million his predecessor, Weber, was owed to not coach at Illinois. Groch's contract also calls for him to make every effort possible to land employment in a related field as soon as possible. Should he land a job, his buyout would be offset by his new salary. Whether or not the buyout is guaranteed is a critical factor, said Champaign attorney David Sholem, who has represented Weber and former U of I football coach Ron Turner, among others in the ACC, Big East, and SEC. Sholem negotiated Weber's deal in such a way that not only did the coach get about $1.5 million in annual compensation when Kansas State hired him in 2012, he also received 3 checks for $1.3 million apiece from the U of I. Bradfield's fate will be up to voters. State's attorney believes clerk lacks authority to remove him from ballot from Urbana. Rex Bradfield, the Republican candidate for mayor of Urbana, won't be prosecuted for voting in last Tuesday's Democratic Party primary, Champaign County State's Attorney Julia Reitz said on Friday. The decision apparently means that Bradfield will oppose Democrat Diane Marlin in the April 4th mayoral election. The state's attorney's office has reviewed the applicable statutes and case law and has consulted with Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton. It is our opinion that, given that Mr. Bradfield has been properly certified as a candidate by the City of Urbana, there is no statutory authority for the Champaign County Clerk to remove Mr. Bradfield from the ballot for the April general election. We are declining to proceed with considering perjury charges against Mr. Bradfield, as we do not believe the circumstances rise to the level of a criminal offense. Holton had suggested last Thursday that Bradfield might have perjured himself by voting in the Democratic primary and by signing a statement that I am affiliated with the political party indicated by my ballot choice. Bradfield, though, contended that an election judge at his polling place in Urbana assured him it was okay to vote in the Democratic primary, even though he is the Republican candidate for mayor. He said, "Go ahead and take the ballot. There's no problem with it," Bradfield told the News Gazette. Reitz said she is leaving the matter to the voters in the city of Urbana, or without commenting on the viability of such a suit, to a private party to bring a civil court. Marlin said she wouldn't use the courts to try to stop Bradfield. "I decided I would just leave this up to the election authorities and let them sort it out." Bradfield, meanwhile, said he was relieved by Reitz's decision. "Nothing's changed. In fact, I've got some people on the Republican side now who are helping me. I'm surprised at the support I've got now." Mark Sheldon, the former county clerk and current county recorder, has signed up to help Bradfield in his spare time. "He is so politically savvy," Bradfield said. "He is just so smart about this stuff. I'm looking forward to it now." The free media coverage of his voting snafu may turn out to be helpful. "I'm sure on TV a lot. My gosh, I've been before the camera 3 or 4 times today. I'm really looking forward to it." "As a professional land surveyor, we cannot use the word mistake when we make a mistake. We have to say blunder. I made a blunder, and now I'm on TV because of it." It's like Sheldon said, they're going to put your race on there a lot. A letter to the editor. Growth of solar energy good for Main Street. J. Winston Porter's nuclear-powered electric vehicle commentary inaccurately describes the potential of solar energy. Solar energy costs much less than nuclear energy, and capital is rapidly shifting to solar energy. Solar industry employment is already more than twice that of nuclear and coal industries combined, with 123% growth since 2010. Solar employs 300,000 people compared to 42,000 in nuclear and 73,000 in coal. Solar industry jobs are Main Street jobs located in all our communities. Solar energy can easily power our EV transportation needs. U.S. automobiles are driven 12,000 miles per year, requiring 3,000 kilowatt hours of energy. 200 square feet of solar panel area, equivalent to the roof space above a garage car bay, will supply this energy. The installed cost of a 200 square foot solar system is $7,500 with no tax credits. Over a solar system's 25-year lifetime, solar-powered transportation costs 2.5 cents per mile. In contrast, 30 miles per gallon gasoline-powered automobiles cost more than 8 cents per mile. As Illinois residents know, the state is removing $2 billion from our pockets to prop up cheap nuclear. Our local community understands the economic benefits of solar energy, with more than 80 local solar systems scheduled for installation this year with a combined capacity of 650 kilowatts, enough for 3 million miles of EV transportation. Solar power achieves the economic hat trick of increasing employment, shifts spending from Wall Street to Main Street, and keeps more money in our pockets. Ty Newell, Urbana. Rodney Davis should take a cue from military. As a former enlisted soldier and captain in the U.S. Army, I understand the duty to protect and defend the rights of fellow citizens, even those with whom I vehemently disagree. I never asked whom my commanding officer voted for or concerned myself with the party of the current president when called upon to defend the values of democracy on behalf of our country. We all have a duty to defend the fundamentals of our democracy. These include the free exchange of ideas and consideration of opposing viewpoints. This is why I'm so offended by U.S. Representative Rodney Davis's unwillingness to listen to constituents whom he believes did not vote for him. Constituent service is a nonpartisan duty, a duty implicit in the role of the office of every freely elected official. When Congress is in recess, all constituents should have the opportunity to meet in person with their elected representative, whether they voted for him or not, whether they are eligible to vote or not. I don't always agree with my fellow citizens' points of view, but I devoted part of my life defending their right to express themselves. The least he can do is listen. William D. Strout Butte, Bloomington. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, March 6th. Please stay tuned.